I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Chris Bohjalian has written 25 novels throughout his career, including The Flight Attendant, Midwives, and The Sandcastle Girls. His newest is titled The Amateur, and it draws from a few aspects of his own life, particularly his experience working as a caddy in high school. Unlike his own life, though, The Amateur follows the days and years after a promising young golfer kills a caddy in a freak accident. Chris Bohjalian and I recently spoke about this amateur golfer and the ramifications on her life. Here's our conversation. Now, because this is in all of the materials promoting this book, we know that it's not a spoiler to say that The Amateur begins with a tragic accident. Can you set up the book for us?
Sure. The Amateur begins with a prologue. Mira Winston. In 1978, she is 18 years old, and she is a golf prodigy. She crushes it. She destroys the men at her club all the time. She's going to go to Yale, and then her plan, the LPGA. But on an August Thursday, maybe a month before she's supposed to go to college, she does what she's done 10,000 times. She drives a golf ball through the practice net at her swank country club in a suburb of New York City, and it powers through the net. And she kills a nearby classmate, Kenny Foster, a caddy, completely derailing and changing her life. The book asks that before and after question. What if a little piece of string, a thread, torn, a tiny golf ball, completely changes your future?
So as you mentioned, the book begins in 1978. This is just after the Vietnam War and through the second wave of the women's rights movement. And our narrator, Mira, is reflecting back on this incident that happened to her that you mentioned was in the prologue. And she's writing a memoir now through her adult lens. Talk to me about the choice of setting the book at this time.
The book is set in 1978 for reasons that are both prosaic and profound. Here's the prosaic. I was alive then. I was a caddy then. Those were the summers in high school when I would caddy at a country club that my parents could never afford to have joined. So I was often caddying for my classmates' fathers and mothers. If my classmates were ever at the country club, they were there to occasionally play golf, but usually to just hang out at the pool or the tennis courts. The profound, such as it is in anything that I write, I wanted to explore a couple of things. The class divide in America, which is as real as ever, but also the place of a young woman in 1978. Mira Winston, my narrator, is a ferocious competitor. She's good. And she knows she is good, and it infuriates her that she isn't taken seriously because she's a girl, because she's a young woman. And the novel explores those issues, not merely on the golf course, but in all of the neighborhoods around the golf course, New York City, the punk rock clubs, when she finally does go to college, and of course, tragically, in the bedroom.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because at certain points in the book, Mira would reflect on the differences between the late 70s and 30 years later when she was penning this memoir. She would point out some of the social mores that were acceptable at the time, like rape, which was never reported. She talked about names of drinks, Daddy, I don't want to drink this, and Caribbean pass out punch, and then asked rhetorically why so many drinks for young girls suggested roofies. What's going on here?
You just nailed it. Back in the day, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, drinks for women were essentially really toxic, potent, but unbelievably sweetened liquid roofies. And the name suggested that. Daddy, I don't want to drink this. And pass out punch. Mira Winston, and this isn't a spoiler, has been having an affair with a 44-year-old man since she was 15 years old. A golfer, a married man and father at the country club where she plays. She's nearly raped. She's sexually assaulted in high school by another classmate. And when her response to this near sexual assault is rage, it is Mira who's viewed as the problem child. It is Mira who's viewed as the difficult girl.
You mentioned these dark secrets that Mira has, especially her affairs with older men, much older men. And there were numerous references to the novel Lolita about obsession and child sexual abuse. And Mira even has a quote from the book tattooed on her arm. "You took advantage of my disadvantage." Can you talk about the influence of Lolita on Mira and perhaps its influence on the structure of this novel? Because, I mean, both were written as memoirs, right?
Lolita's, of course, Humbert Humbert's quote unquote memoir. The Amateur is Mira Winston's memoir. Spot on. You took advantage of my disadvantage. Mira has it tattooed onto her arm at one point. And one of the, I don't want to say a running joke, one of the running horrors in the book is, of course, her dawning understanding of Lolita as a work of quote unquote art. So that at one point, when Mira realizes that her affair with an older man is going to become public, she confides in a high school classmate of hers that she's really worried about Theo. And now, with the perspective of age, Mira looks back and says, "Isn't it ironic? When I was 18 years old, Lolita was worrying more about Humbert Humbert than herself."
You're listening to Marginalia. Our guest today is Chris Bajalian, author of the novel The Amateur. Now, Mira is, by all accounts, extremely privileged. You mentioned this early on, the differences in class. Her family is well off, members of the private golf club. They can easily afford attorneys and prestigious college educations. How does Mira's social class affect public perception of this accident?
Oh gosh. Privileged white girl kills young boy of promise. Kenny Foster is a young boy of enormous promise. And I should also note that Kenny Foster, just like Mira Winston, is a fictional version of me. That was me, not merely because I caddied at that country club, but I moved there with my family just after I finished my sophomore year of high school in Miami, Florida. Just like Kenny Foster, I was the kid trying to fit into this really elite community in Westchester with a closet full of polyester leisure suits and huckapoo shirts and one real strength. I could do the hustle. I was really good at disco dancing, which in Bronxville in 19, in the mid to late 1970s, was not a talent I needed. So yeah, I did want to explore that part of the class divide. When Kenny is killed by Mira Winston, Mira is really thrown under the bus by all of the adults who should be looking out for her, as well as all of the corporate entities that are trying to protect themselves. The country club. Where do they place the net? The net manufacturer, was it defective? Now, couldn't have been. Someone must have tampered with it.
You mentioned that Kenny is you, for all intents and purposes. Are you still a golfer? I mean, I'm
Am I
curious.
still a golfer? I was never a
So
golfer.
talk to me about your research.
I was a really good caddy. I mean, I was a terrific caddy. And I really enjoyed it. Being a caddy was a great job. I made a ton of money by my standards. I had a great tan. I was unbelievably buffed. And between my morning and my afternoon loops, I would sit in the shade and read great books. I did begin to understand, though, the weirdness of the class divide. My classmates weren't caddies. My classmates' parents were members. And while my family wasn't poor, we were kind of like Scott Fitzgerald's family. We always lived in the worst house on the best block or the best house on the worst block. At one point, I went to 5 schools in 6 years in 3 different states. And the reason why we wound up in Bronxville, which was this Tony suburb in which I went to 11th and 12th grade, was because they had a great public school. And my parents wanted to make sure that I was going to a great public school. But when Mira kills Kenny, Mira is the one who's going to be vilified because she's the spoiled, snotty, snarky, ferocious girl.
You know, there are times when it seems that Mira is well aware of her privilege, but then other times when you're not so sure. So this brings me to the subject of likable characters. Mira muses, if we wanted only likable characters in our novels and movies and plays, there'd be no Macbeth, Anna Karenina, Pulp Fiction, Sharp Objects, or the talented Mr. Ripley. And I certainly don't need the characters in any book I read to be likable, but we all probably know someone who will not like a book if they do not like the characters. So do you have an opinion on likable characters?
I have Mira's opinion on likable characters. I care about good literature and good film and good TV series, and sometimes you have likable characters and sometimes you don't. You just went through a litany of books with not especially likable heroes and heroines, but they're amazing works of art and they're incredible page turners. So, Mira Winston, first of all, I do like Mira. I think she's very funny. And the thing about The Amateur is that a lot of the book is very, very funny. And Mira's got a lot of great, I think, asides. But there will be readers who will judge Mira as dislikable because she does act out, because she does make a lot of bad choices between the ages of 15 and 21. But I would push back and say, any of us make good choices between 15 and 21? A lot of the things that Mira does are things that I actually did. And no one ever thought I was anything but the life of the party. The frontal lobe is what it is when you're 18 years old. And it's very different from when you're 38. And Mira is aware of this. And at one point even says, I fear you don't like me.
Mm-hmm.
But she's going to tell her truth because it needs to be said regardless.
You know, despite the decades-long gap in which Mira is narrating this memoir about the accident and the effects on her life, she repeatedly insists that she's a reliable narrator. Is she?
She is. At one point, she even says, to all of you wonderful readers in your book group, sipping your Chardonnays and your Merlots, you're debating whether I'm reliable. Well, trust me, I'm telling you the truth. I am reliable AF. Now, like any first person past novel, there's a question in my mind of believability. For example, The Great Gatsby. Nick Carraway is, of course, giving us word-for-word dialogue from 4 years earlier. Word-for-word. And all first-person past novels are like that. What we hope to do is suspend disbelief sufficiently to accept this is a reliable narrator unless the narrator reveals him or her or themselves to be otherwise. A book like The Secret History, we know that that narrator is a liar because he tells us he's a liar, but we also tend to believe that everything he's telling us in The Secret History is basically what happened.
Now I'm trying to figure out how many books you've written, because you have collections of short stories and essays and plays too. But you've written over 20 novels, right? Is it 25?
The Amateur is my 25th novel. It is my 26th book because in the collection is my book Idle Banter, which is a series of essays and columns I wrote for years and years for mostly the Burlington Free Press, a Gannett paper in Vermont, but also the Boston Globe and a variety of other places where these Reader's Digest, where these stories appeared. And yes, I've written three plays, and I've written not a lot of published short stories. Maybe there are a dozen out there.
So I read a piece in your Substack titled The Heroine's Journey, or Why So Many of My Protagonists and Narrators Are Women. You said that the stories that interest you demand an emotional openness that a lot of men of your generation lack. Can you talk a bit about that?
I can. And I think this was the perfect novel to address that. At one point, Mira Winston even says, I think the only reason why golf was invented was so that men would talk to each other. Men of a certain generation, perhaps every single generation born before maybe the year 2000, don't tend to talk to each other about serious things, which is why golf is where they have their most profound conversations in some cases, because you never have to make eye contact. You are staring straight ahead, walking for hours, or these days riding in a golf cart, staring straight ahead or following the flight of the golf ball or staring down at the ball on the putting green so you can reveal things you might not otherwise reveal. I first noticed this the summer between my junior and senior years of high school when I was caddying. And I would listen to the men speak and I would realize that, you know, I have never seen men ever talk about these things in other places. Not all my years, you know, watching men play tennis or at my parents' bacchanalian dinner parties where the booze flowed like chocolate fountains, only on the golf course. So to go back to your question, often, not always, the books that I write demand that the main character makes the sort of emotional journey that I'm not sure most men are willing to make. For instance, my novel about the Armenian genocide, The Sandcastle Girls, is also narrated by a female version of me, not a male. And the reason for that is because her entire deep dive into her family history is triggered by a photograph she sees at the Armenian Museum of America in Watertown, Massachusetts, that she realizes, based on the caption, might be someone from 1915 in Aleppo, Syria, who's related to her. And I don't think a man would completely upend his emotional equilibrium to do a deep dive into ancestry the way Laura Petrosian does in that novel.
Have you listened to the audio of The Amateur?
No, I've only heard a clip. And the clip that I heard, I thought was fantastic. I mean, when we were talking about narrators and Melora Hardin came up, I jumped at the chance and I said, oh, please, I would be grateful beyond all words if she wanted to narrate this because she's a great actor. And listeners might recall her as playing Michael Scott's lover for four seasons or so off and on of The Office, Jan. And she is not merely a brilliant actor, but she's got the perfect voice, it felt to me, to bring Mira Winston to life.
I'm always curious if the actors reading the audiobooks are ever given, you know, character study notes. Like she came across as very self-assured.
Mira, it is. And Jan in The Office was.
Yeah. A few weeks ago, we spoke with the author, Jenny Jackson, who is also an editor, and your editor, is that right?
Jenny is brilliant. Oh my gosh, she is such a fantastic novelist. I loved Pineapple Street. I love her new novel, The Shampoo Effect. She's a great friend, and she is the world's best editor.
In what way? How does that work?
Well, Jenny and I, okay, first of all, I've been with Penguin Random House for 31 years now, since 1995, and I've had two editors. I had Shea Earhart, who is great, just a treasure, from 1995 until she left in 2010. And when she left in 2010, I literally asked for Jenny Jackson to be my new editor. And I asked for Jenny to be my editor for two reasons. It was really clear from our experiences together when she was beginning her career as a paperback editor that we had a very similar taste in literature. And B, she is way smarter than me. And so the way we've worked together since 2010, good Lord, I think we've done like 13 books together. The way we work together is this. Usually, and I'll tell you the reason why I say usually in a second, is I will send her 60 or 70 pages of a book, say, what do you think? And she will either say, love it, let's do it, or I don't love this one. And in which case, I'm really pretty content to abort mission and find something that we're both going to have a lot of fun with. Then she will see it again, maybe at the midpoint, and then she'll see it at the end. And she's really good at offering a macro view of the book, what is fundamentally working in her opinion and what isn't. But she's also really candid about saying, essentially, it's your name on the spine, not mine. I can give you my best advice. And her best advice is brilliant. The Amateur was different. For the first time in my career, I told no one what I was writing. Not Jenny, not my agents on two coasts, not my lovely bride who has read every one of the 3.8 million words I've written before they were published, not our daughter who's become one of my most important readers. I told no one because the premise seemed so crazy that I was afraid if anyone knew this is what I was trying to do, be both the instrument of death and the dead for a story that was basically a fictionalized version of so much autobiography that people would just say, no, do not go there. This is crazy. So, in a 90-day frenzy, I wrote the novel. It was the summer of 2024. And at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning, I tucked the document into an email, addressed it to my lovely bride, our daughter, to Jenny, to my agents on both coasts, and put in the subject line simply, how I spent my summer vacation and pressed send.
Clearly, it worked.
It did. It did. By Tuesday afternoon, everyone on that chain had read it, and it said some version of, wow, this process clearly works for you. Don't ever tell us again what you're working on, just send us magic. Which is really encouraging. Even at my advanced age.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from The Amateur?
Well, I hope they have a great time with it. I hope they read it and feel that it's a page turner and that it's propulsive. But like all my books, I also hope they feel at the end a combination of heartbreak and hope. And the endings really matter to me in books. It's kind of like being a gymnast doing a floor routine. You can be fantastic for 2 minutes and 55 seconds, but if you don't stick the landing, that's all that anyone will remember. And so when somebody closes one of my books, I want them to have the feeling I have sometimes when I close a book by, oh, I don't know, Elizabeth Strout or T.R.E. Jones or Amor Towles, and I might be weeping in the woods with my dog because I'm listening to it on an audio, perhaps, or I'm reading it in bed beside my wife and I have to surreptitiously wipe a tear away from my eyes. I love it when my books give readers that experience, heartbreak, and a modicum of hope.
Well, the book is The Amateur. Chris Bojalian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh my goodness, Beth. I thank you. Thank you for celebrating what words and reading and books can mean to the soul.
The Amateur by Chris Bajalian was published by Doubleday. And now, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a new memoir by a man who rallied the forces of TikTok to finally learn to read.
In 2021, fitness influencer Oliver James had a massive social media following and a secret he had been keeping from all those people and most of his real-life friends and family members. He did not know how to read. At 32, James was living a lie, using technology, his memory, and those around him to conceal the fact that he never learned that symbols make letters, which make words, which make meaning. At school, he struggled with undiagnosed learning disabilities and mental health challenges. He never failed a grade, but he also never learned to read. His new book, Unread, A Memoir of Learning and Loving to Read on TikTok, chronicles how James became one of more than 45 million functionally illiterate adult Americans, and how he used the very tools of our post-literate society to finally master the complexities of reading. The memoir begins with that day in 2021 when he pressed the red record button on his phone and uttered what he says were five magic words to his TikTok following. "What's up? I can't read." That post went viral, and it didn't take long for the BookTok community to embrace him and pledge to help him on his journey. Thousands of tutors, many of them teachers and professional reading coaches, joined him on TikTok Live every night as he learned to read. He set a goal of reading 100 books in a year, and one by one, he knocked them out, from Goodnight Moon, to Stone Soup, to Charlotte's Web, to The Alchemist. The whole list is included in the back of James's book. Each chapter of the memoir also uses a specific book to help illustrate the author's point. S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders helped him understand social divides, the way people get trapped by the labels society puts on them, and how those labels can shape your entire life, James writes. He relates to main character Ponyboy Curtis, he says, because, like me, Ponyboy is trying to understand the world beyond what he'd been told. And when Johnny tells Ponyboy to stay gold, "That hit me so hard," James writes. "It's about holding on to the part of yourself that still believes in something, that still hopes, that still sees beauty even when life is ugly. Reading gave me that." In Unread, James tells the full story of his journey from illiteracy to authorship, including how not knowing how to read made day-to-day life difficult. He couldn't follow a GPS because he couldn't read road signs. He could give a friend a birthday card, but not really know what it said. He couldn't play board games or read instructions on a pill bottle. He could not shop for ingredients to cook a specific dish because he couldn't read a recipe. "You can't even make Kraft mac and cheese if you can't read the instructions," he writes. "I had to be shown how, then memorize it." He continually depended on others to understand basic information, and that led to feelings of inadequacy, guilt, and self-blame. James's memoir sometimes gets repetitive as it's more about reflections than plot, but it offers insight on a largely silent crisis affecting about 21% of Americans. It's a poignant story of courage and resilience, and a moving reminder that it's never too late to learn. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Unread by Oliver James was published by Union Square and Company. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
The fatal shooting of a teenager at a protest in Seattle has gone unsolved for 6 years.
This is open in your face. How are there no answers?
Our investigation has uncovered new evidence and witnesses who say they've never talked to police.
Did police ever call you?
Not once.
Listen to We Keep Us Safe, a new true crime series on the Embedded podcast from NPR.